Good morning, everyone. We'll go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Thank you for being here. We do not have any measures, so we won't be doing a work session for introduction of measures. What we will be starting will be public hearings and possible work sessions. Starting with Senate Bill 378, we'll open up a public hearing. Laura.
Thank you. So Chair Pruszynski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 378 comes to us at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary. We have no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and no amendments before us today.
Do we have a list of suspects who might be testifying today?
Thank you. So current Oregon law defines the term boarding kennel as a facility that provides care for a feed of dogs that stay at the facility an average of less than 30 days. This language is used in multiple ORS sections, specifically sections addressing dog breeders. The statutes governing dog control laws, however, do not define boarding kennel. So Senate Bill 378 defines boarding kennel using the same language found in other ORS sections, and it specifically excludes dog breeders from the definition. It clarifies the definition of keeper, and it specifically excludes boarding kennels from that definition, and it clarifies license fee applications and specifically excludes dogs considered inventory.
Well, I can see we have a lot of people who want to talk on Senate Bill 378, like no one signed up. So let me ask, is there anyone here who would like to speak on Senate Bill 378? Not seeing, we'll close the public hearing on 378. And we'll open up a public hearing on 383. Laura?
Yes. So Chair Pruszynski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 383 comes to us at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary. We have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. We do have a -1 amendment before us today. It removes the language practicing in the same jurisdiction to clarify meaning and intent. So Oregon's Certificate of Merit statute outlines requirements for bringing a claim against a design professional. Current requirements include a certification by the claimant's attorney that they have consulted a licensed design professional who is qualified, available, and willing to testify to admissible facts and opinions sufficient to create a question of fact concerning liability. The intent of the statute is to help determine which claims against design professionals lack basis and which warrant the court's attentions. This is important, it said, as the actions are often complex, involve many parties, and may involve frivolous claims. Senate Bill 383 clarifies the Certificate of Merit statute by amending claim requirements. It does this by, number one, dropping construction from the term construction design professional. That term is not used anywhere else in statute. Number two, it defines design professional as a person licensed or registered under ORS Chapter 671 and 672. And third, it outlines what standards of professional skill and care a potential expert witness must address. SB 383 also provides an exemption to claim requirements for public bodies. It applies only to complaints, cross-claims, counterclaims, and third-party complaints filed on or after the effective date.
All right, thank you. We have three individuals that are signed up at this point to give testimony on Senate Bill 383. And I have John Larson, Jeff Meyer. Why don't you two please come forward as proponents. And I have Art Towers currently listed as opposing. So, gentlemen, thank you all very much for being here. If you can give us your names before your testimony, that'd be appreciated.
Absolutely. I'll start. Thank you, Chair Pruszynski and members. My name is John Larson, and I am a lawyer practicing law here in Oregon. I've been practicing law in Oregon for about 17 years now, I think, and I practice primarily in the area of defending design professionals, which are typically licensed architects and registered engineers. I have familiarity with the Certificate of Merit pleading requirements under ORS 31300 and support Senate Bill 383 as, I believe, a reasonable adjustment of the Certificate of Merit pleading requirements. Right now, we have a pleading requirement that requires the lawyer representing a claimant to affirm to the court that they've consulted with a qualified expert, and that expert has said the design professional failed to meet the standard of care and caused damages. That's the summary of the Certificate of Merit that we have in the state. My experience, however, is that in too many instances, I know for a fact through settlement negotiations, which are privileged and can never be brought up in court, that the claimant's attorneys have, as their expert, very experienced people who aren't licensed. They aren't architects. They aren't engineers. They've been contractors for 20 years. They know a lot about construction generally, but they are not licensed in the areas where they're criticizing my clients. And that's the primary focus of Senate Bill 383. It's to try to have architects testify or offer opinions to plaintiffs' claimants' counsel about a failure to meet the standard of care, to have like licensed professionals reviewing, critiquing, and criticizing similarly licensed professionals. That's the primary goal of Senate Bill 383. One of the criticisms that I've seen from the opponent who will be up here speaking in a few moments is a concern that this SB 383 expands the list of occupations covered by the Certificate of Merit. I don't believe that's the case. If you look at SB 383, at the very beginning, in the very first section, it describes the licensed professionals to which it applies, and it doesn't change or add any sorts of additional licensed professionals that are being covered by the Certificate of Merit. So I don't see that as a valid criticism. The other criticism that I've seen in the written materials by the opponent is the addition of the word original in the, line 12. And I can see a little bit of justifiable critique about that word because these lawsuits, and we're dealing with, at least in my experience, some pretty complex defect claims where there are multiple parties, millions of dollars at issue. And as the case goes on, the lawyers and their experts learn more about what went wrong and why. And as a result, amendments are very, very common in these construction defect cases. So I think that there's an appropriate tweak here to say that the first time the design professional is named as a defendant, then you've got to follow these requirements of ORS 31300 as hopefully modified by SB 383. Thank you.
Thank you. And let's see, Jeff, you will go next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to speak to you today. My name is Jeff Meyer. I'm an Oregon registered architect. I've been practicing architecture here for 23 years. I am also a member of the American Institute of Architects and the National Council of Architectural Registration Boards in Washington, D.C. And I am also the founder and president of Meyer Group Architects, Inc. in Portland, Oregon. I'm also a registered architect in the states of Washington, California, Idaho, Nevada, Utah, Wyoming, and Colorado. So I'm quite familiar with the different laws throughout the western states, but primarily I practice here in Oregon. In my opinion, the architects in our state are facing a serious, serious problem. And from my perspective, the reason for that is that we have a state statute that all Oregon registered architects are bound to, which says that we, as Oregon registered architects, will protect the health, welfare, and safety of the public. That is an extremely broad responsibility that is on our shoulders. To my knowledge and belief, no one else in the design and construction industry has that same standard and that same bar that they have to meet. So what's happened in my experience in Oregon is that since Oregon registered architects are tasked with protecting the health, welfare, and safety of the public, it's created a scenario that over the last 23 years in my career, I've watched litigation increase more and more and more because it's quite easy for a plaintiff to assert a claim against an architect and say that that architect did not protect the health, welfare, and safety of the public. It's very easy to say that when you are tasked with taking responsibility for things that are beyond your control. Primarily, what I'm talking about is construction and construction defects. As an Oregon architect, I don't build buildings. I'm not licensed to build buildings. I don't deal with the means and methods of construction. I am a design professional. And as a design professional, I design buildings. But what happens in these claims that John has just mentioned is that usually there is some sort of problem with the building's performance, and that's usually related to a construction defect. So what happens is They will sue the contractor that built the building. They will sue the owner that developed the building. They both usually have created disposable limited liability companies. But we architects can't do that. It's too expensive to insure it, and it's too difficult to manage it. And since we have the task of protecting the health, welfare, and safety of the public, the theory goes that since we didn't stop our client and our contractor from being stupid and cutting corners in the field, the fact that we didn't stop them, we're negligent. But as I've said before, we are not given guns and badges. We are not given the legal authority to stop the contractors and the owners from doing things that we know as professionals do not meet the standard of care and do deviate from our construction documents. And that's a real problem for us as architects. So what's happened in our state is insurance rates have gone through the roof. My company pays about $150,000 a year just for professional liability insurance. That's with a $100,000 deductible, which is very easy to burn through when our friends in the legal community bill $300, $400 an hour. And so the issue has become one of financial strain, where the architects are under such duress and such pressure, they're having a hard time supporting these costs, and it's creating an industry that is very, very, very difficult to practice within. So I'm here to support this bill because I think that if I've done something wrong, which happens, mistakes happen, then I should be judged by my peers here in Oregon. As a Washington architect, I can tell you, I'm not qualified to be an expert witness in Washington because most of my projects are here in Oregon. Washington doesn't require construction phase services from an architect. Oregon does. Oregon's got different standards of care and different laws in effect that shape our industry here in Oregon, specific to Oregon. We're not California, we're not Washington, we're not other states. Other states do things differently. I'm not saying they do things better, and I'm not saying they do things worse. They do things differently. But as Oregon registered architects, if I do something wrong, it seems unfair and unreasonable that a plaintiff attorney can bring in somebody, as John said, that has maybe some construction experience, or one time I saw a gentleman that had a PhD in environmental science, and he was the expert, even though he had no knowledge of construction or design issues whatsoever, but he knew about environmental issues. The problem is that these people come in, they place these claims. The real goal is to extort cash out of insurance companies. That's the real goal. And so it's hard when you have to get an architect that's going to actually say, hey, as an Oregon registered architect, I'm going to certify that this fellow Oregon registered architect did not meet the standard of care in this state. If my fellow Oregon registered architect says that, then I probably really made a mistake that's pretty serious, and I should be held accountable. But it's not reasonable to bring hired guns into our state to cause more turmoil and more pain and more financial duress on the architects of this state. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? I have two, and the first one is for John. When you went through on line 12, you talked about the word original. Are you comfortable with that word being excluded from the bill and where it would just read made part of the complaint, cross-claim, et cetera, et cetera?
Chair, it's better by removing it.
Okay.
You know, we could even consider a tweak that says something along the lines of the first time a claim is filed against a design professional. Something along those lines, just off the top of my head.
Okay.
But your suggested change is better than as written.
Okay, thank you. And then I think the question for you, Jeff, based on your scenario, if you're on a project and you actually see the contractor cutting corners, et cetera, what is your duty? I mean, what do you do when you see that? How do you document, or can you just walk us through?
Yes, I can, Mr. Chairman. That is a scenario, unfortunately, that happens quite frequently. I could write a novel on this issue. As a side note, I think, unfortunately, the fact that owners and contractors can be one and the same within the state of Oregon is also a serious problem within our system. Because what happens is the architect becomes the ham and the sandwich between the contractor and the owner, who are both trying to get the project done as cheaply and quickly as they can. To answer your question, the state law says that if, one, The owner has relieved you of your construction phase responsibilities and duties, which are all outlined in our Oregon revised statutes. The first thing that the Oregon Registered Architect must do is inform the governing jurisdiction and the Oregon State Board of Architects. We have had that happen. We have had to inform the jurisdiction and the State Board. Usually, that's the first, that's the end of your relationship with your client, usually. But let's say that they had actually hired us to do the construction administration, and we're in the field, and we see that a contractor's ignoring our drawings. It happens. First thing we do, same thing, inform the governing jurisdiction immediately. Inform the owner immediately. But here's where it gets into challenging territory. Many of the inspectors are contractors. Many of them have very deep relationships with the construction personnel. They look at the architects and engineers as, we're the smart guys that are over designing everything. And unfortunately, many contractors, especially those that have come up the ranks through the single family world, because that world is different than the commercial world in terms of laws, they really will believe that if they've got an inspector to sign off on something, it's okay. It's all right. Couldn't be further from the truth. Because the engineer and the architect that have stamped those drawings and specifications, they are taking responsibility and liability for those drawings and specifications. They are the licensed professional in responsible control of the production of those drawings and specifications. So if I see a contractor deviating from the design intent in our construction documents, I tell the owner, who usually says, are we saving any money? And if the answer is yes, they'll accept it. I tell the governing jurisdiction. They'll usually say, okay, duly noted, but if I feel it's satisfactory, I'm going to sign off on it. But again, back to the problem with the duty of health, welfare, and safety, and our job is to protect it. They just went and deviated from something that I know isn't right.
So let me just go through this. It sounds to me that you say you tell them. So
just in writing.
So you document it.
Absolutely.
They know it at the owner's level. They know it at the jurisdiction, the governing oversight.
Correct.
And then I guess if it gets to the point where you feel very uncomfortable with it, you can terminate your contract?
No, I cannot terminate my contract. I am bound by my contract.
And your contract doesn't allow you to actually get out where there's a point of where you feel that health and safety is now at risk?
It does not. In fact, I can expand on that, Mr. Chairman. What would happen is if I went and terminated my contract, I would probably be sued for consequential damages. And even though I have in my contract waivers of consequential damages, they would still assert a claim against me because in Oregon, it's pretty arduous to go through a process, and they would probably be able to extort some cash out of the insurance people. So what options do I have as an architect? I mean, I would love to stop people from cutting corners. John and I have seen, unfortunately, numerous construction defects where the drawings are very clear. Put flashing here. Make sure you do it this way. You will insulate it this way. All the basics. But unfortunately, we're the only one tasked with protecting the health, welfare, and safety, and the owners and the contractors feel, hey, we know better, and if we can get away with it, we'll do it. This is also a source of ADA and fair housing claims because there are manufacturers out there that will represent their products are compliant with ADA and fair housing, yet ADA and fair housing are civil rights laws, not building codes. So, again, I could go on and on and on and write a novel about the problems that we have, but this one piece, the Certificate of Merit modification that we're talking about today, is a small piece that will help minimize some of the broad liability that we as design professionals are facing.
Thank you. Any questions, follow-ups? Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward. I have Art Towers on the list to testify. Art, are you on your own or do you have anyone else? Art, looks like he's on his own. You're a brave man.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Art Towers. I'm the political director for the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. In my 15 years in the Capitol, this is my very first time testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee, so please be gentle.
I kind of looked out of the way.
The So thanks for the opportunity to come testify today. We look forward to further conversations with the proponents of this legislation because, as I understood their testimony, they spoke to quite a few challenges that the architects are facing. High insurance rates, the owner and contractor being the same person, a lack of locally certified experts on behalf of consumers, and the architects cannot get out of contracts when the health and safety is at risk. Unfortunately, it doesn't feel like this legislation addresses many of the problems that the previous witness outlined. We do believe, and we'll kind of work with them to get to the bottom of it, we do believe that the law as written does expand the list of people covered by this law. The ones I identified by reviewing the statutes were geologists and photogrammetrists, I believe. Learned a new word for map makers last night. So that's one place where we see an issue. The expanded certificate or expanded definition of the certificate is a new provision and creates a higher standard for consumers. Because our job in this process is to represent consumers and make sure that consumers get a fair shake in the course of this process. And so creating this new barrier, I think, is another step forward. The previous witness testified that things are different in Oregon. They and you know, more challenging for architects, and I appreciate that. The law protecting architects is also different. This concept of the certificate in advance is unique to this field, and so they do have the additional protection already. Again, my written testimony kind of speaks for itself. I'm happy to answer questions. I would say, though, that a couple points that the previous witnesses made that I just wanted to respond to. One is that they talked about the inspectors being all local and that creates a problem because the inspectors all have all might be a strong word, but have deep relationships in the community and deep relationships with the contractors, and that's a problem. But they're asking for the same sort of thing among the expert witnesses as well. The expert witnesses must be locally certified and registered as well. And so it seems like it creates an analogous situation to what they claim is a crisis on the other side. And then finally, I do want to take a little bit of exception to the idea that this is all about extorting insurance companies. This is about protecting consumers. Our job is to stand up and fight for consumers, whether it's auto insurance, whether it's defective products, whether it's in other civil suits around protecting children and child abuse cases, or broader consumer protection issues. We're about protecting consumers, and so we want to stand up here for consumers as well. We're willing to work with the proponents to see if there's a path forward. I think that on some of these instances, there well might be. But I just wanted to raise the flag for this committee today to say, let's take a look at this to make sure that we're doing what needs to be done. And the that we're really tackling the problems and listening to the testimony. I think that they raise serious problems. I think that our folks could write a work also on the problems that they're facing. Hopefully it wouldn't be a novel, but it would actually be a work of nonfiction. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Questions? Art, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 383? Not seeing anyone come forward, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 383, and we're going to go and open up our last public hearing that we have scheduled for today, which is Senate Bill 386.
As Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 386 comes to us at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary for Oregon Health and Science University. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on this bill, and we're not looking at any amendments today. So under current law, a public records exemption exists for persons engaged in or providing goods or services for medical research using animals other than rodents at OHSU. Legislation creating this exemption originally passed during the 2003 legislative session and contained a sunset provision. The sunset provision has since been extended, most recently during the 2011 legislative session. At that time, the legislature enacted an operative sunset date of January 2nd, 2016 for OHSU's public records exemption. Senate Bill 386 removes the sunset provision entirely. It does not change the existing exception to OHSU's public records exemption when it is in the public's interest to disclose.
All right, thank you. So we have a number of individuals that are listed to testify. I'm going to bring up a first panel of Bill Donovan, Jason Davis, and Dr. Nancy Haywood. Bill, you're going to lead off?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Donovan here on behalf of Oregon Health and Science University. Thank you for bringing this legislation forward today. The Oregon National Primate Research Center at OHSU has world-class research programs. However, the researchers, we can't attract and retain them if they do not feel safe. That's why Oregon has the researcher safety law, which is a statute that provides crucial protections for researchers, their families, for their colleagues, while at the same time maintaining without jeopardizing public transparency. As you heard, the law has been in place for over a decade. The last extension was passed unanimously by the Senate 3 years ago. And since that time, we continue to receive animal record requests, and we've responded to them without complaint. With me today is Jason Davis, OHSU legal counsel, to talk about some of the specifics of the law. And also with me is Dr. Nancy Haywood, who is the director of the Oregon National Primate Research Center, and a scientist herself. I've had the opportunity to tour her lab. She's doing exciting work in the field of HIV treatment and vaccines. And she's here to talk a little bit about the importance of this law to the people at OHSU. So thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could, I'll turn it over to Jason.
You bet. Thank you. Jason?
Chair Przonski, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee, my name is Jason Davis, and I'm legal counsel at Oregon Health and Science University. As previously stated, this bill will lift the sunset on the research safety law, but it makes no other changes to the law. The researcher safety law allows OHSU to exempt the following information when the public requests information about the research being conducted with non-human primates or a researcher whose work includes work with non-human primates. It allows exemption of the name of the OHSU employee or researcher, the home address of that OHSU employee or researcher, as well as the name and address of companies that provide goods and services for non-human primate research, such as companies that raise animals for research purposes or provide supplies such as food or caging. The public still receives all of other information regarding proposed or ongoing research, including the specific description of the scientific protocols, the justification for the use of the animals, plans for the animals' well-being, highly detailed records of the care provided to each animal, and the terms and conditions of the contract, including payment terms under those contracts. The reason this law is in place is because extremists have used public records requests to get the names of research personnel and connect them to specific projects. They have then used this information to fuel support for intimidating and violent act against individuals and their families. The researcher safety law is not intended to keep animal research records from those who request them, but rather merely removes the name and addresses to prevent the intimidating and violent act against those researchers and their families. The detailed records outlining the care and use of the animals remain available under the public records law. We believe this law provides balance between the needs of the public to receive good detailed information about the care and use of the animals, while protecting individuals and their families from the threat of violence. For that reason, we urge you to support removing the sunset. Thank you, and I will turn it over to Dr. Nancy Haywood.
Thank you. Doctor?
Thank you very much, Chair Przonski and members of the committee. My name is Nancy Haywood, and I'm the director and a senior scientist at the Oregon National Primate Research Center, and also an adjunct professor of molecular microbiology and immunology at OHSU.
Doctor, I'm going to ask you to take the microphone and direct it down a little bit more, make sure we get you recorded.
How's that?
Thank you.
Great. On behalf of the scientists and animal care staff at OHSU, I would like to thank you for hearing my testimony today in support of Senate Bill 386. This legislation is very important to us, to myself and my family, as well as my colleagues. Before we speak about the importance of the Research Safety Act, I'd just like to ensure that the hundreds of talented researchers, technicians, and veterinarians are safe from violence. I just want to mention a couple of the aspects of our research. We do have world-class research programs in infectious disease, in neuroscience, and reproductive science. And our researchers, technicians, and veterinarians and animal care staff work to find treatments and cures for deadly and costly diseases. And three examples in the last couple of years are that we have uncovered new avenues for fighting AIDS in babies that are born infected, contracting the disease from their mothers. We have a new vaccine showing promise for AIDS that will likely move into clinical trials within about 1 year. And finally, as has been in the news recently, we've developed a new gene therapy technique that can prevent the devastating genetic mutations found in mitochondria from being passed from mothers to babies, recently approved in Great Britain. We're dedicated to the health and well-being of the animals, and our dedicated staff members provide round-the-clock veterinary care. We ensure that our primates are provided nutritious meals and enrichment activities, and they maintain clean, disease-free environments. There's a strict, rigorous scientific protocol for all research that takes place, and nothing can be done in a non-human primate until those requirements have been fulfilled. They're almost as strict as human protocols for human clinical work. The studies that make it through this process can advance medicine significantly, and we believe that we've seen that already. The use of animals in research and the treatment and well-being of these animals, as you know, is regulated, overseen by the United States Department of Agriculture, the National Institutes of Health, the Food and Drug Administration. In addition, we're overseen by the Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee and the Federal Office of Laboratory Animal Welfare, OLAW, to whom animal care incidents must be reported. The work of individual researchers and staff and the way they use and care for their animals is closely scrutinized by these entities. Much of our research is funded by tax dollars, and we feel we have the responsibility and obligation to inform the public of the goals of our research, the advances that we make, and we welcome public scrutiny and scrutiny of our research and of our process. We have community outreach programs that educate the community about what we do. Unfortunately, as you've heard, tactics by some animal rights extremists, whom we define as individuals who use illegal and menacing means to incite violence against scientists, have changed. And the FBI has documented a shift in tactics from targeting institutions to targeting individual scientists and their families, including their homes and personal property. Over the last 11 years that this law has been in place, 8 of which I've been here, the ability to redact the names and addresses of people and businesses involved in animal research has significantly helped me and my colleagues from experiencing the property damage and intimidation that has occurred and continues to occur in other states. I believe that the release of public records without individual names provides meaningful access to detailed public records without compromising the safety of individual researchers, staff, and their families. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Just ask him. All right. So I'm fine as with the testimony as to what we heard. I guess the one thing we didn't hear is what's been going on since we've had protection in place. There was an issue on the beginning of the setting the protection that individuals who were identified as media were not maybe having access. Do we have any information that you can provide to us as to how frequently requests are now coming in? I've got the impression that it's kind of like dwindled to the part where we're not seeing as much activity in the sense of request for documentation to be released.
Chair Przanski, we, in the past 3 years, received 17 animal record requests, not all of which required redaction because of the breadth of the request didn't necessarily bring names of researchers and technicians. Also in that time, we did not receive media requests. would go on the record, though, Mr. Chair, as we discussed 3 years ago, that media requests are treated the same as any public request. The only difference is that it routes through our media office so that if anything, you get just an extra set of eyes to make sure that we're responsive.
All right. Any other questions or comments?
Chair, this is kind of deja vu all over again.
It is. That's why I was looking just to see if you had any follow-up, since it's been a while since you sat on the committee.
Right, and I get more and more comfortable with this. It was a struggle for me to get there when we first did it, because I'm such a believer in transparent government. But when I saw some of the materials about how basic training sessions for some of these people to get addresses for the specific purpose of harassing people, that's what tipped me over. And so I've been watching it while I was on the committee before. I watched it very carefully to make sure it wasn't the proper information was still getting out, and I've been assured that it is. So I'm very comfortable with this bill, Mr. Chair.
Wonderful. Any other questions or comments? Thank you all very much for coming forward. We have two hired guns who wanted to testify today. Joe and Brian, why don't y'all come on up?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Joe Basler, humble servant of the workers of AFSCME. We represent 24,000 members across the state, and 116 of them work at the Primate Center. Our folks aren't the researchers. Our folks are the people who take care of the primates, the fair, feeding, keeping, cleaning, and they love their job. I mean, we've had conversations with them over and over again that they can tell if a primate is injured or sick from just looking at them. They take their job very seriously. They also take detailed notes on what's going on with the animals. And so their names are all over those reports. And so we've seen in other states where it's not just the researchers who are getting targeted, but it's also my folks or their comparables. And so we think this is really working well. We think the information is important and is getting out there, but their names and addresses, I don't think, serve a good purpose to get out there. And I want to think not just of the researchers, but also of our people too. So it's a really good bill. Please pass it.
Thanks, Joe. Brian.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Brian Beringer with the Oregon Medical Association. Represent over 8,000 of Oregon's physician assistants, and medical students. And while a number of our folks are the researchers, we also have a number of our folks that are also in the caretaking of the animals out at the Primate Center. And I just want to say that even our members that don't touch the Primate Center, they can't do and offer the kind of patient care that they do without the kind of research, world-class research, that goes on in our own backyard at OHSU and across the world. And so these are members, and these are researchers, and these are workers that are caring for the animals. They're doing lawful work. They're doing lawful research. They're doing federally approved and overseen research, and they deserve to be safe in their homes, their families, their kids. It's just what we owe them. So we also encourage your support of Senate Bill 386 and hope that you move it along.
All right. Thank you very much.
And why do you keep bringing such controversial bills?
I know. These are really tough ones. All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 386? Not seeing anyone rushing to the front. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing. I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 386.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 386 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 386 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And the chair is more than willing to carry the bill, but I will defer to a good senator from Portland if she would like to carry it.
Your choice, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to carry it if you'd like me to.
Mr. Chair, I think because Senator Burdick has probably paid more attention to this because she was the chair when we first got into this area. And her comfort level, I think, is important, and I think her carry would address that issue. So,
as the vice chair says, Senator Burdick will be our carrier of the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to Chair, aren't you going to have the others vote?
All right, so that's that. We'll take care of that. So I'm going to go ahead and call back, see if anyone has come in for Senate Bill 378. Is there anyone here that has come in late? We have actually had our public hearing, which was no one showing up. We'll figure out what, if anything, needs to be done on that bill at this point. And so with that, I think it concludes our work for today. We're scheduled tomorrow, I am not mistaken, 8:30. And so with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing, close the committee for today. And I would like to speak to the individuals that are involved on 383, if I got that right, 383 afterwards. Thank you. Afterwards. Thank you.